Sarah, and thanks to you for hanging out so long on Friday. Well, I hope this will be a kind of provocative talk, and it's what I would like to relate to the science that is done at this place. Different from biology, the kind of science that people in something TP do dates back to the days and to systems where experimental manipulation is not possible. So we are the offsprings of Kepler, and Kepler could not kick the planets, and that is still a problem for, or apparently is no problem for many physicists that work on systems in which experimental manipulation is practically infeasible, or things that happen only once. So for instance, our colleagues here are pretty convinced that when they look at the sky and very carefully quantify the properties of some background radiation, they will learn something about the things that happened way back in the past when our universe sprang up. So systems of that kind force the scientists to be very humble. We cannot try it again. We cannot push black holes and stuff in the fashion that a science like biology, which is rooted in the experimental method, seems to require for any obtaining any kind of reliable knowledge. Now, what I would like to share to you with you today is our trials to push studies of visual cortical development and structure in a direction that disciplines itself to this kind of approach. Just quantify very carefully what happens normally, and alongside do mathematical modeling that you can drive to a precision, so you can start to tell the difference between an epicycle and an ellipse, and see whether a Keplerian approach can be to any good. And that forces us, on the one hand, to make good use of the mathematical techniques that 20th century physics has accumulated and put in as a toolbox for us. And on the other side, also care very much about the quantification of these maps of the experimental observations. And that made us run into things that we first didn't even think about, which is genetic control and so on. So quantifying biological data is a useful thing in itself, whether your theoretical dreams work out or not. So the system I'm talking about is presumably familiar to each of you. Oops, how would I start a movie in this presentation though? Okay, I have to find out how this goes. Wait a second. Well, I think that's the problem. So what's a good resolution here? Okay. Okay, it's a very widely known system, the system of orientation columns in V1. So these are animations of recordings by optical imaging of intrinsic signals of orientation domains in V1. Here you see a 3x4 mm piece of third visual cortex, and up here you see the visual stimulus that was shown to the animal, and now as an animation, you see the activity pattern recorded by intrinsic signal imaging. When you imagine that rotating square wave grating is shown to the animal, And to highlight one important feature of this organization, I indicated a little region where you saw that the activity domain here, dark means activated tissue, was circling around a center. These centers are known by the name of pinwheels and are a structural feature which is very common in visual cortices of higher animals. This is ferret, and I'll show you an example from other species later. And they come in great density, so here you see in this 3x4 millimeter piece, you have 1, 2, 3, countless of those. They come in two kinds, the simplest two kinds that can be imagined topologically, ones that they are distinguished in the sense in which the different orientations running from 0 to 180 degrees are organized, either clockwise around such a center, such that your activity domain would cycle in that way, or counterclockwise around that center, such that the activity domain would cycle in the opposite way. Now, I like this system for exactly the opposite reason that Henry liked the birdsong system. It is actually too complex in many respects. First of all, this is a pretty complicated spatial picture. It's never repeating in space. Although these structures, the local structures, are all over the place, it's not a crystal or something simple. Biologically, it's a pretty complicated tissue. That's also a reason why I like it, because for the foreseeable future, I don't see any chance to do quote-unquote biophysically realistic simulations of the formation of this structure in any reasonable sense. And therefore, this is a system that requires more abstract approaches where theorists can be useful. Our approach here has a prehistory that I would like to mention briefly, also because Alex contributed significantly to it. 10 years ago, I did a numerical study, numerical analytical combined study of many available models for the activity-dependent formation of these orientation maps, and found that although very early, when the neurons in these models first become orientation selective, the maps looked qualitatively very similar to the experimental measurements, as the ones I showed you. When you let the cortex evolve in the model, there was a process that we termed pinwheel annihilation, where pairs of these topological defects collided and vanished, and were therefore replaced by linear zones. And in the long run, led to a more stripe-like organization that doesn't really fit well the organization that is found in experiment. That poses the question of pinwheel stability, and at that time when we submitted this paper, I was sure that the next month some lab that would do time-lapse imaging would see pinwheel annihilation because it's so robust in models of visual cortex development. Well, these experiments have not turned down over the past 10 years, and at the end we may discuss why that happened. But a large number of theoretical groups picked this observation up and took the issue serious that pinwheels apparently survive in visual cortex, although the period of plasticity and of large turnover of synapses, spines, and axons lasts many months, much longer than it is initially required to set the system up. So one attempted solution to rescue pinwheels was published by Alex, together with Mitya Shklovsky, and they studied a model in which the layout was predicted from the requirements, from the abstract requirement, that you want to have short wire length in total in the tissue, given a certain prescribed rule of who should be wired to whom. And when in a regime where they required that quite different orientation preferences should need to be wired, they found that in the optimal arrangements, there were pinwheels present.
Can you just pinpoint pinwheels annihilation once? What would
So that's one simple explanation. It could be, and I'll tell you in the end why I don't. So it's in principle, it's conceivable that you just break the symmetry and it's quenched and frozen. And then what we would need to describe these patterns is the theory of random patterns, right? And I'll show you examples of that. Yeah. I'm not really much in favor of that hypothesis because there is a lot of turnover, a lot of learning going on for a long time after the symmetry is initially broken. And well, let's discuss the purpose of the pinwheels later. If I had more time, I would end up with a hypothesis what the purpose of the pinwheels are. Okay, here the purpose of the pinwheels would have been to make the wires short. Yeah? If you put pinwheels at these strategic locations, the overall length of wiring needed would be minimized, would be optimal. But unfortunately, this is also not a really convincing model for this pattern. And as Henry points out, a random pattern would be actually more similar to this and maybe a good candidate for what we are seeing here. Yeah. 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 I'll illustrate your point. Yeah. But so that's what I. The perspective that we are trying to push is that the question that I want to answer is, can we view this as a complex ground state that is really optimized? Or should we, like Handy, suppose, think that it's a random arrangement, something that was generated by symmetry breaking, somewhat refined, and then got stuck in the complexity of biological matters, because the brain really doesn't care where the pinwheels are. That's two different hypotheses, and I'd like to give you some examples how mathematical analysis can gain some ground for answering those. So the question is, which type of model can reproduce really this? And that's an important question, I believe, because if we think that this is optimized, then with this model we have to conclude that this is not optimized. Okay? Agree? So to make progress, we use the simplest conceivable mathematical description of the layout of these orientation maps, which is you take a complex number z as a function of x. X is position in the cortical sheets in 2D, parallel to the axes. And that's sufficient to tell for every position when you take the face of this complex number as an angle, that is the orientation preference, up to a factor, and the magnitude of z as the degree of selectivity of the local population. That's the simplest conceivable mathematical object that can describe the spatial organization of this pattern. And it has, in addition, the advantage that it is exactly what is obtained in an imaging experiment where this structure is measured. It's a director field. But it's a poor man's version of director field. You could use a tensor, but you can also use a complex number, and we are using complex number. In this language, the zeros of this field z of x are the pinwheel center position. And our approach now is to ask ourselves, now, in development, this structure is set up initially that certainly there is a phase where neurons are unselective and not organized in space like this. And over time, visual cortex manages to set up this structure. The simplest conceivable model for this process is a dynamic equation that tells you, now the map is a function of time. How does it change as a function of time? The assumption here is that when you know the map today, you have a good basis to predict how it will look tomorrow. And the question mark is, what is the rule to follow in order to predict the map tomorrow? And I told you that this is very complicated. And we are following, again, here not Kepler, but Einstein, if you want. Yeah? Think back now 100 years. Einstein came up with a theory of gravitation on large scales, scales where we cannot smash things into one another, which would be, he had no, basically no experimental basis for coming up with the theory of relativity, which is used every day in this institute and widely believed. And soon enough, we'll have gravity wave detectors that may prove it or bring some advance there. Now, what is the recipe to make progress in the absence of a lot of experimental constraints? It was symmetries. And the same recipe is what we are following here. So there, the very idea that the neurons in visual cortex are not pre-programmed to become, so this neuron to become horizontally selective and this neuron to become vertically selective is a symmetry assumption. If it's evolving by learning mechanisms and driven by activity, then when one kind of arrangement of orientation columns is an admittable solution for the wiring up problem during development, then also translated versions or translated or rotated versions or shifted versions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Translated or rotated or shifted versions are equally good designs for visual cortex, and making the assumptions that whatever this right-hand side is should be symmetric under these transformations greatly reduces the number of admissible model equations. Okay, there are boundary conditions, so Henry points out that I'm heading here towards a model for an infinite extent visual cortex. I think this is an okay approach because the hypothesis that pinwheels are there because visual cortex is finite is not what we want to check here, and on top of it is a large aspect ratio system. So you have like 400 hypercolumns in V1, and therefore for large aspect ratio system it's important to have to start with the infinite brain limit. Otherwise, it's counterfactual idealization. So, how many time? Oh, how much time? It's 12:20. So, I'll very briefly. Michael will give a talk on extensions of the model that I'm introducing now, and I'll just show you in three pedagogical simulations how we use symmetry to come up with what we currently call our standard model for visual cortex development. I'll show you as a starting ground a model that has very well characterized the Swift-Hohenberg equation for a complex field Z. It's the simplest equation that will produce a pattern with a typical spacing, like the millimeter scale in cortical columns, and which will converge, so it's a variational problem, it will converge to an optimum of a functional in the long term. And as Henry said, so this is starting from random initial conditions, and see initially there's the emergence of a fairly complicated looking pattern, but over time it relaxes to its ground state, and then most of the pinwheels are gone. And the point that Henry mentioned is a conceptually important one. If I was willing to stop, then you could start to argue, well, this looks pretty much like the real thing, so maybe that is what's happening in biology. It's an interesting hypothesis. If time allows, I'll show you that it's not likely to be true. But this is what is happening in 95% of the published literature in the modeling of this system. Yeah. So that's a very, thanks for that question. I use these equations only as the simplest examples. I use this in particular because I perfectly know what it's going to do, and I'll modify it in two more steps to end up with an equation that will mimic visual cortex. But they are not meant as the, I'm not standing here and telling you the equation of motion of the visual cortex. That would be, I think, a misguided idea. So in nonlinear dynamics, we have come to think, and in statistical physics as well, is that the space of different models with respect to certain properties can be decomposed into what is called universality classes. And there are branches of mathematics on the mathematical physics in which people only care to find the simplest representative of that universality class. And that's what I think these equations are. So the true model, I believe, is in the universality class for which we find the simplest representation. But I don't think that this approach will give you the equation of visual cortex. That would be stupid. Richard. You could put noise and therefore try to counteract the convergence to a... That's not noise. So I think it is reasonable to restrict oneself to variational problems. So the complex Ginzburg-Landau equation is not variational. That's why it has persistent dynamic space-time chaos. But all the evidence there is, that it's not too much, doesn't indicate that there's a constant turnover of orientation counts. And the perspective that is prevailing and I think most interesting is that this is an optimization problem, or very similar to an optimization problem, and then you wouldn't expect persistent rearrangements. But you are right, there are model equations which have space-time chaos and which produce defects like those. But then your visual cortex would be in a constant turmoil, and which would be also cool, yeah, but it's not the hypothesis I'm checking now, yeah. There is only less than a handful of such studies. Yeah. So there are many imaging studies, but what you would need to see whether there is rearrangement is chronic recording, time-lapse imaging in the same animal. And that's what I would say. There are two published papers on that. But there's no specific prediction. I think it doesn't predict that they should be the same. Let's discuss this later, okay? So one thing that is missing here, that's a structural feature of nervous systems in general, is that, so here, this unit C of X, the columns, only talk to their very immediate neighborhood. It's a derivative of the field, and up to that, it's just the value at of this column that enters the right-hand side. Now, in the brain and in nervous systems in general, neurons are distinguished from other cells by their ability for long-range communication. They can send signals to far apart neurons in almost the same time as to their next neighbors, as demonstrated here for the visual cortex in the classical paper by Bosking. The black dots are presynaptic terminals superimposed on the orientation preference maps of primitive neurons located here where the white crosses are. So these neurons can easily talk to guys that are several wavelengths apart. What happens when you build this type of interaction into such a model equation that's done here? So here we have the old local term, and then we put besides it the simplest non-local generalization of such a damping term, which is instead of T absolute value square as the damping coefficient, you use an average over a region of size sigma in order to dampen the growth. That's isotropic, yes. And that's the problem with it. But let me go step by step. So this is a simulation of this augmented model in a thermidor regime where this non-local term actually plays a role. So it does some good to the outcome. Early on there are tons of changes. So.
But it's not just a stable state.
It's again, it's not stable. It decays in a interesting fashion, so it loses almost all orientations. Only two orientations survive in this model. But it took us one step closer to visual cortex design in that this pattern does not. It's also aperiodic in space. It has a typical spacing in it. It has certain elements that come back every now and then, but it's an aperiodic spatial pattern. So what is missing here? The kernel is, so I mean, okay, I didn't say. So this comes from Göttingen, this is a Gaussian. But the form of the kernel is not a critical feature. You can put an exponential, you can actually also put a power law if you want. The features I'm discussing here are insensitive to that. So there's one symmetry that I broke by making this naive generalization. That's only for Henry probably, or for the mathematicians among the crowd. So I put this model this term into the equation where you have, so it needs to be a third order term. I want two of those to be from column at y, and the other one it is felt by the column at x. And by symmetry reasons, one of them has to be the complex conjugate of the field. So the term I choose has the complex conjugate on c of y, but you could also put it on c of x. There's no mathematical reason not to do that. And when you look at it from a symmetry perspective, there are three different positions where you could put it, and a symmetric choice would have just the sum of these three possibilities. Then you haven't made an unintentional choice of one possibility among the different. And that is what you end up when you symmetrize. Yeah, sure.
So you have two y's and one x.
Yeah.
So why does it matter in which y you put it? Why is the first term different from the third term?
The first term and the third term are the same, yeah? Right. But there are.
But you have to have two of those versus one of the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and that, this term now is selective for the relative angle in contrast to the previous one. And now we've already arrived at the model equation that we are using every day, which produces this simulation that I'm showing you here. So there, when you start from random initial conditions, early on, as every symmetry breaking mechanism, it generates a pinwheel rich pattern, but that you will find in almost every equation that belongs to this rough class. Pardon me? I think that's an issue for a more extensive discussion. So it's the nonlinearity. So this is published. Everybody who wants to study this in more detail, there's a PIL 3 years old in which I actually demonstrated. So there's a theorem that comes with this model that this permutation symmetry, you can generalize it, that guarantees that all orientations will be represented in every possible stable long-term state. Yeah?
So let's go back to the fact that we use a complex variable mm-hmm. that contains an amplitude and a phase. So could you explain, in terms of the phase, what exactly means then? What does it mean to have CF conjugate, and what is the relevance of having the absolute value of CFY versus CFY squared?
I think so. No, it will be a private discussion. Yeah, but it will. Then I can stop the talk after the answer. And so there are no genes yet. Yeah. So let me. I'll stop it. Okay. Skip all the. Well, no. That I have to do that. Yeah. Now there's one. Yes. Yeah. So now comes a random choice of the stuff that I've prepared for presentation. And one of them is to, so it may look to you as if in this, so this is the phase diagram of that model. Here graph is the range of interactions. There is the parameter G that determines whether the local term or the non-local term is dominant. Below G equals 1, the non-local term is dominant in the pattern selection. And there you see that for longer and longer ranging interactions allowed, you enter a range of aperiodic patterns that mimic the organization of orientation columns in V1 qualitatively. And in this regime, there's actually, you can calculate the number of different attractors, and it's exponentially large. So it's really, it's a nightmare of a model. But fortunately, it has so much symmetry that you can handle all these different phases in one go. Lambda is the spacing of adjacent orientation domains.
Where does n show up in the
spacing? Where's n? What is it? Oh, so n, this is the number of solutions. If you count the little n, where's the little n? Okay, that's the number of Fourier components that you need to describe the. It's not in the equation, it's an index of the solutions. Okay, and so there's one particular thing. So it looks like that almost every pattern can be found in this regime. Yeah? There's a ton of solutions. But there are rules that clearly distinguish things that can be formed by this type of equation from things that are forbidden. There are forbidden patterns. And I would like to illustrate that by a thought experiment. So think forward like 10 years when neuroscience will be so advanced that it can offer something, a service similar to piercing or tattoo. So you go to your neurotechnologist and ask him to put the names of your heroes into columns of your visual cortex, by a training paradigm or by transfection, that might be then possible. And now, so that's what you have done to your visual cortex out of reverence. And now if a really very large set of orientation column layouts would be admitted, then if you just leave the rules of visual cortex organization to reign again, instead of your neurotechnologist direct experimental intervention, then this would stay. But if we, in this model, start with such an initial condition, even though these are who you saw, they will be wiped out by the rules of cortical self-organization. Okay. And that's the simplest illustration that not everything is allowed here. It has a large repertoire, but there are strict rules that prohibit certain kinds of manipulation. Now, in the past 10 minutes. Well, I'll answer Chuck's question, okay? I'll skip the genes. So if I promised you we one of our intentions is to very carefully quantify these patterns, and there are two things that are the minimum you have to really care about, which is first the wavelength, and there's a substantial inter-individual variability about that, and pioneered by Matthias here. We put a lot of effort into precisely calculating that lambda. And here you see, so that's how we ran into genes. Here you see wavelengths calculated from a set of, how many? It was 40 or so kitten hemispheres. And so we pushed this analysis to a point where we could estimate the spacing of orientation columns up to 30 micron precision, insane level of precision for much of biology, But it was very useful because we discovered that hemispheres from littermates clustered, and although wavelengths can differ up to half a millimeter between different kittens or different cats, littermates typically have wavelengths that are no more than 40 micron apart from each other. That was really surprising to us, and to our knowledge, the first indication is not perfect proof that some of these parameters are under a fair degree of genetic control. The other thing that is needs to be quantified minimally to move this from a qualitative to a quantitative level is how frequent these pinwheels actually are. So you have to count their numbers, and because the size of orientation columns differs between individuals and between species, you have to relate the number of pinwheels to the hypercolumn size of that individual in that species. And therefore, it's required that you first have a good idea, a valid approach to estimate lambda, and then start to count pinwheels and start to compare. And the last results I'm going to show you is from a comparison of orientation maps in three different species that are as widely separated as mammals go that have orientation counts. So one of them is the ferret, a key model animal in visual cortex physiology and development. Second one is a primate, the Galago, and the third one is a tissue related to primates, but split off. All of them got separated in evolution roughly at the time when dinosaurs were still around. So if you want genetic differences to accumulate over time, that is a set where you should have a fair chance to find differences. Also in the requirements and the layout of their visual system, these three species are quite different. So for example, the tree shrew is an extreme example of the cone-dominated color vision animal. It's the only example I know where that has a cone, almost a purely cone retina. It lacks ocular dominance cones, which are a hallmark of many others of the mammalian species. The ferret is basically colorblind. They differ in their cortical organization, the Galago and the ferret, with respect to the organization of ocular dominance. Their habitat and visual requirements are very different. Some of them hunt, some of them eat fruit. Their vision might be adapted to perfectly different things. So it makes a lot of sense to, in order to explore whether visual cortex organization is different or specialized to visual function, to look at these species in detail. And here are three examples. So you see they all have orientation counts, and you also see that these orientation counts come in different sizes. So the scale bar here, 1 millimeter, applies to all three V1 maps. So ferrets, you see, have pretty large orientation counts compared to pinwheels, and all the quantification of pinwheel density that I'll show you is with respect to the intrinsic spacing of these columns in the different individuals and species. One has to go very careful in quantifying that because, I mean, you see as every biological measurement, as every measurement, this comes with a fair amount of noise. So this is a raw data from two pieces of this visual cortex, and indicated here as lambda is the cutoff spatial frequency of a low-pass filter that was used. Now, when you just count zeros in this noisy data set, of course, you will count very, very many zeros that are not pinwheels. And so when you filter this with a cutoff frequency of 0.6, a lot of the high-frequency noise is reduced, and you can find discrete zeros that you could consider, that we consider prototype pinwheel positions, and counting them would give us a pinwheel number. But essential here is to check that this number that we come up with does not depend on the details of the preprocessing. Otherwise, we could tune our filter and just get any number. And that's demonstrated down here. The graph here is the pinwheel density in units of intrinsic spacing, so that is the average number of pinwheels per hypercolumn for these two regions as a function of the low-pass cutoff frequency. And you see that there are large, that's a discovery that Matthias made, and that is the basis of all this quantification, that over a large range of filter parameters of cutoff frequency, this estimated pinwheel density is actually invariant to the preprocessing. And that's why these plateaus are, in our opinion, the best proxies for the true pinwheel density in such a measurement. That requires a very careful choice of the filtering, but it's also it would blow my time to go into the details, and you should discuss it with Matthias. So here is the upshot. So these are, well, I think, roughly 200 hemispheres from these three species. Blue are the tree shrews, yellow the Galagos, green the ferret. Graph here is the absolute pinwheel density per square millimeter of cortex versus the inverse hypercolumn area. See, they fall on a straight line. So if we normalize it and obtain a non-dimensional pinwheel density, that is a flat function as graph versus hypercolumn size. And so you recognize again there are species with large hypercolumns, with small hypercolumns. But nevertheless, when you count the number of pinwheels per hypercolumn, that seems to be a quantitative invariant of visual cortex design. Well, are there no interspecies differences then? Oh, this is only one statistic. Okay, so we look further, and if you look at the mean, you should also look at the variance, and that's done here. So when you look at different subsections of V1, so one hypercolumn, two hypercolumn, 10 hypercolumn size subsections of a V1, there's a certain variability of pinwheel density that you estimate from these different size chunks of V1. And of course, by the law of large numbers, the bigger piece of cortex you take, the more precise your estimate of pinwheel density becomes. So this count variability is the next order statistic that one has to consider to check whether there's really universal statistics of these pinwheel patterns. And that's graphed here, so the standard deviation of pinwheel density estimate as a function of hypercolumn number in your chunk. And here are, again, in the same color-coded three species, up to like four or five hypercolumn-sized chunks, they fall perfectly on top of each other. So there's also indication that the count variance of these structures is virtually identical in these species. The visual moves up above the other has more count variance when you look at really large chunks of cortex, and that's an interesting phenomenon, but beyond the scope of this Friday talk. Yeah. No, this is the only data set that I know from these species that's of high enough quality and large enough size to make that. And you, by our wavelet method. So what we do is to take a what's the name of the wavelet? A Molly? No. So a Gabor-like function of different size and different orientation, and find the size that best fits the local patch. And that's, so the wavelength of this Gabor that best fits, that's what we take as the estimate for local periodicity. That's important in some species in which locally you have big counts in one end of V1 and small counts in the other end of V1. In a more homogeneous pattern, you could take the Fourier transform. But for these calculations, we use the wavelet method, which gives you a lambda for each hypercolumn that may be different. In the tree shrew, it's often not. Correct? Hmm? Yeah. The next statistic that we checked was, maybe the design of each hypercolumn follows different rules. So that should show up in the distances of different types of pinwheels with their next neighbors. So here are the distance distributions for next neighbors, whatever their sign, and different sign pinwheels, so a left turning one and a right turning one would have this distance distribution, and two right turning ones, the next same sign neighbor would have this distribution, and all these distributions also fall on top of each other. So that amount of similarity encouraged us to say, well, maybe we should pool the data. It seems there is this universal density. We have like 10,000 pinwheels in the data set that may give us a precision of 1% estimate what that universal pinwheel density is. And so our Keplerian approach led us to a number that rings a bell. What's this? Yeah, sure. So something has to be around in the head, and I'm running out of time. So I would be very happy to discuss, and Matthias and Michael and Wolfgang certainly also, what we do to make sense of this number. Now, it's not so often that when you take a lot of hemodynamic responses and count the zeros in a careful way, that you end up with a number that you learned in math. And that's the thing that we're very happy to get input on, and that we think is very, very constraining about in terms of what can generate this type of structure. But so this is just the appetizer, and thanks so much for your attention. What's the use of pinwheels? What are pinwheels good for? Okay, so that so first of all, this property, the pinwheel density close to 3.14, is lost when you randomize the data in many of them. Generating pseudo maps that have the same two-point correlations but random phase. So that's why I think that this freezing argument is not very consistent with this finding. The model that I described to you, that I constructed from symmetry consideration, has in the long-range dominated regime, these are the blue simulations, so here as a function of time, pinwheel density of different initial derived from different initial conditions, selects a pinwheel density on average that coincides with the data. But this only works in the long-range dominated regime. So from our modeling, we conclude that there might be other explanations, but the only one that we have in our hands is that in the rules that shape the orientation columns, long-range interactions should be really important. Now, if this is optimized for processing visual input, that means that the design of visual cortex really has to care about relations of far apart contours. So if we want to interpret this as in terms of a functional optimization principle, I think the candidates are to optimize orientation column layout for the representation of entire scenes, where you have to make sense of long-range correlations of contour elements. So the use of the pinwheel would be to help to enlarge the representational repertoire of V1 for extended and complicated contours, instead of just putting every orientation in every little patch, an orientation meter that tells you it's 15 degrees over here.
Is it
Yes, and that's a symmetry question again, and I think Michael's talk will give you a fair amount of answers. So there are correlations that we actually also quantified that seem to that are indicative of multi-contour effects in the layout. But the overall statistics of the visual world, as long as there are long-range correlations, the number of pinwheels, we think that is fairly robust. So in terms of theoretical physics work, you have, of course, in order to be anywhere certain about this, to check that breaking the symmetries does not make the theory fly apart. So there are many idealizations in this, and that's where a lot of our work went into over the past years, and that will also blow the timetable, but we'll be happy to discuss this in time enough. Who has ever checked that? So that's an important point. Jonathan Horton has published this wonderful review that I really like, entitled "Cortical Calms: A Structure Without a Function." And he argues that there are these big differences in calm layout in different species, and they seem to have no functional consequences. But I haven't seen the research program that has really tried to test that in any serious fashion. It's all anecdotal evidence. So it might even be that lack or presence of ocular dominance calms has some thing in perceptual ability going with it. I don't see that it has been tested. Well, it's actually, so that's a specific experiment, cutting out the pinwheels as opposed to the rest. And that would test the hypothesis that the cells in the pinwheels do a specific job. And I think that our modeling indicates that that is not why they are there. So if you think what types of contours this type of map represents well, and what type of contours this map represents well, that is very different. But it's not what the cells in the pinwheels do. They are like railroad stations where complicated contour patterns can diverge or get a richness that a pinwheel's sparse pattern would not generate. So the answer to, in that sense, the answer to Matthias' question is that the pinwheels per se, meaning the neurons that are sitting there, they have no special purpose. But in order to have a good representation of the entire of visual images, so they are there because over long distances things need to be coordinated in a particular fashion. So the pi is the circle number, so where does it come from? So in these solutions, rotation symmetry is only weakly broken. And that's a perceptual deficit, if you want, of this type of design, when you care about more than guessing local orientation.